Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And it's my honor to welcome Edward Ferguson, the Minister, Counselor, Defense at the British Embassy in Washington, D.C., who in his distinguished career also served as Her Majesty's Ambassador to Bosnia-Herzegovina, experience that has prepared him well for duty in today's Washington. Edward, thanks so very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks so much. Lovely to be invited on.
It's a terrific pleasure having you on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. We are now in a very, very consequential time, obviously, for the United States and the United Kingdom. Johnson administration is working its way through Brexit. Coronavirus, it has unfortunately killed more than 40,000 Britons. And we don't know whether or not this is sort of late phase one or the start of phase two, given that there's a rise in cases. But it has precipitated the worst economic crisis, according to The Economist in the UK, since the Great Frost of 1706. Against this backdrop, Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's right-hand man, has launched this integrated defense and security review. British friends of mine have said, look, this is a very, very worthwhile exercise in part to bring sort of the long-running, lofty British, if somewhat unachievable, ambition in line with sort of political and fiscal reality. In as much as you can talk to us about it, what's the state of play in the defense review and its integrated nature and the kind of trade-offs that that the government is looking at, because it is quite wide, and putting any criticism aside, trying to do it in a thoughtful, broadly based way?
So it is. It's a really interesting review this time around. I used to be the head of strategy at the Ministry of Defence when we were doing strategic defence and security reviews, which in turn was a sort of broader scope than the previous strategic defense reviews. This is an integrated review of foreign policy, defense, security, development. Really, it is about the entirety of Britain's global outlook in this post-Brexit world, and how do we redefine the role of Great Britain in this, you know, increasingly complex strategic environment. You mentioned COVID. You know, we've also got the backdrop of growing strategic competition, including between the US and China. Russia still on our doorstep, still aggressive, unfortunately. And of course, you know, technology you know, continuing to develop at an extraordinary rate. And so some really big strategic kind of challenges that we're facing, as well as some big opportunities. And so the integrated review is really designed to do the knitting across that you know, broad framework, and try and work out how to best use the full range, the full spectrum of government capabilities. Not just our armed forces, but also our intelligence agencies, our diplomats, our development agency. You know, many of these areas, we have real strengths. But the closer we can work together, the more effective we can be. Where are we now? The review is ongoing and is sort of in its closing stages. I'm expecting its report before the end of the year, but probably the other side of your election. You know, you sort of alluded to some of the complexity. I mean, one of the factors is, of course, it's not the ideal economic backdrop against which to be conducting a strategic review. And I don't think it's the one we hoped for. And it's certainly not the one we expected a couple of years ago when work sort of started in this direction. You know, we'll have to take that into account, just as, you know, the United States and all other major powers will need to. And I think that's why, you know, it's really valuable to review your strategic outlook on a regular basis. You know, the last one we did of these was in 2015. We've done various kind of strategic stock takes since then, but this will be an opportunity to really look in detail. And it's importantly, it's proceeding in parallel with a spending review that will set, in your terms, sort of federal government budgets for the next 3 years. So it'll allow us to join together ends, ways and means, and hopefully come up with something that is, you know, genuinely thoughtful, far-reaching, but also realistic in terms of what's deliverable.
Is the 2% figure of GDP for defense? Britain has been very, very proud, to have been you know, having hosted the Wales summit in Newport in 2014, where the 20%, 2% of GDP, 20% of that going to modernization were going to be the goals that the alliance was going to shoot for by 2024, if memory serves correctly. And Britain has been very, very proud to actually achieve those numbers. Is that something that's going to be sacrosanct and even reasonable given the economic circumstance the United Kingdom finds itself in and potentially the impact post-Brexit, right? I mean, I think there's an expectation there will be a drop before the rise. You know, is that 2%, 20% something that's going to survive this review?
Yeah, I think, I mean, 2% of GDP is baked in because that's part of the government's manifesto commitment. So, you know, I'm confident that that will remain the floor, if you like. We're comfortably ahead of above 2% at the moment. I think 2.16 the last time I saw it. And, you know, what's also interesting, I think, is that in the last few years, we've done quite well, actually, in terms of making a case to government for additional resources. So I think last year and this year, we've had an additional 2.2 billion pounds over our baseline budget. So this year we're up to 41.5 billion for the budget. And that's important because, you know, we've got some big commitments. We are renewing our strategic deterrence, so building a new dreadnought class of submarine. We have major shipbuilding programs underway. And we have, you know, new areas that we are investing in, including offensive cyber, for example, which is a major up arrow. And so, you know, what we've seen, I think, in recent times is we've our case has been measurably, you know, strong enough to unlock the Treasury box. We'll have to see through the negotiations that will continue through the Integrated Review and the Spending Review where this comes out. And of course, you know, what the Integrated Review does is it allows the Treasury and the government as a whole to make balance of investment decisions across the entire portfolio of government. And there'll be many candidates for funding, including for pandemic prevention and response, for biosecurity, health security, to name just a few that are slightly beyond the sort of normal bailiwick of defense.
Britain has demonstrated, as it did in eliminating its carrier strike capability. I mean, I remember being aboard HMS Ark Royal when the Royal Navy was somewhat more optimistic than not than that the carriers would have survived the 2010 review. They ended up not, and Britain gapped that capability until the introduction of the Queen Elizabeth and the Prince of Wales, both of which now have water under their keels. Indeed. Obviously, Queen Elizabeth, an extraordinary ship, is getting ready for her first major deployment and has Marines aboard. But let me just ask you about whether any capability is off the table, right? I mean, at the end of the day, one of the things Britain has demonstrated again is that ruthlessness that we don't need the Nimrods. They're going away, even though we spent a lot of money to modify them and extend their service lives, or we're going to gap the carrier capability. So Britain has been willing and very able to take risk and to take it kind of sharply. Is any capability on or off the table at this point? And there is a lot of attention, I guess, being paid, as you know, whether or not the 138 F-35s, for example, is something that's going to survive contact with the review. There are rumblings that that number might get smaller, although I have to say each time there were rumblings that number is going to get smaller, or, you know, a number sort of 150 or 138, 138, I think, is the current number.
Yes.
Is that, and which has then prompted discussion, obviously, among some other partner nations saying, hey, look, you know, Britain is an A-level partner and it was supposed to buy more jets and we're buying them. And do we supplant and just return questions, et cetera? What can you say about sort of the F-35 and the F-35 commitment, especially with the Tempest development ongoing at the same time?
So I think, I mean, your broader question about is anything off the table in the review, you know, obviously the review is ongoing and, you know, I'm not in a position to kind of run through a checklist. But, you know, I don't think, I mean, the UK has not been afraid to make hard choices. You know, some of those in the past have been driven by budget. I think in this review, you know, it's fair to say that a lot of the thinking is being driven by threat and by the changing strategic context and environment. And the need to invest in modernization. And, you know, and we've obviously seen through the DoD as well, you know, during my 2 years here, some big decisions being made by the services to, you know, reinvest, find savings from within the budgets to reinvest in modernization. Our Chief of Defence Staff has spoken of a shift from what he calls sunset capabilities into sunrise capabilities. And we can clearly see that there are some, really exciting technologies out there that we are going to need if we're going to maintain our technological edge over our competitors who are moving at pace. And so we have to, we have to match them on that. The extent of risk we might need to take in certain areas would, of course, depend on the budgetary settlement we get. And I don't want to kind of preempt that.
Right.
But I think at this stage, we are looking at, this is a threat-based review. And so that's the starting point. It's not budget-led. Where are we on F-35 specifically? I mean, F-35, you mentioned the carriers. I mean, it is massively exciting at the moment. I got very excited this week when I saw a photograph of 14 F-35s lined up on the deck of HMS Queen Elizabeth as she went out for her pre-deployment trials off the coast of Scotland. I think that's the biggest fifth-generation group of aircraft on a carrier anywhere in the world. And it's fantastic to see that capability come online. And what's even more exciting for me, who in my current job lives and breathes the UK-US relationship, is that there are US Marine Corps aircraft integrated with the Royal Air Force on board. And that is really superb. It has not been easy. I mean, this is a different force with different legal bases, different construct, different weapon systems. Managing to do that integration is, I think, an incredibly powerful signal, not just of the extent of the interoperability we already have that we've built up over years of working and operating and fighting alongside each other, but just the real strength of will to make this relationship work and to continue to develop it from strength to strength. So I think that F-35 relationship, 15% of all F-35s, of course, built in the UK, so it's industrial as well as military. But it's superb, and I think it will be a baseline and a grounding for our relationship for a long, long time to come.
Let me, before we get deeper into that, and I have to say, it's just an incredible photograph. As somebody who always supported the big deck carrier capability, I mean, it really, there really are incredible ships and well worth the U.S. paying, I think, closer attention to them. But that's beside the point. You bring an extraordinary blend of strategic acumen, diplomatic experience, as well as military experience. And one of the questions that everybody struggles with is, we have a tendency of thinking about military hardware, but can make trade-offs in other national capabilities. It's very, as Jim Mattis used to say, right, if I didn't have the diplomats, I'd be buying more bullets. If I didn't have foreign aid, specifically, was his point. Are we any better at thinking through the quantitative impact of investment, whether it's foreign aid investment, whether there's development investment, whether it's, and to make some of these broader governmental trade-offs, because it ends up becoming very muddled in some cases, right? That the foreign aid is not as effective, and and ultimately everybody reaches for the military lever because they know, yeah, at least it does something now. It looks good politically. Are we getting any better at thinking through these trade-offs?
When you say we, I'll reply for the British, because I think that's sort of where I'm most competent to respond. I mean, I think in terms of the integration, I mean, I think that is in many ways the real attraction of an integrated review like this, and indeed the SDSR, Strategic Defence and Security reviews that preceded it. This was a way of looking across the different levers of government and for making those difficult choices about balance of investment. So looking at the relative expenditure on the Foreign Office as a Department of State, on what was the Department for International Development as our development agency, the armed forces, our intelligence agencies, and so on. We are, I think, always on a journey towards, and I think one of the sort of great value adds really that the Brits can offer is that we are small enough, compared to the United States at least, to be, I think, pretty well integrated across government. Our National Security Council that we created, I can't even remember now, but maybe 10 years ago or so, has really helped to drive that integration at the heart of government in policy, and that has driven, in turn, the capabilities that we have. We did a national security capability assessment just a couple of years ago. We're doing another one now as part of this review. And it's interesting as well that just this year we have, the Prime Minister has announced the that our Foreign Office and our International Development Department have been brought together to create a Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. That integration of our diplomats and our development professionals, you know, has the potential to be really powerful, I think, as, again, a much better integrated tool. It's essentially the equivalent of bringing together state and USAID. So alongside our Ministry of Defence, you know, creating a really, really powerful new joint department that will really drive both our diplomacy and our aid and look at how to make better use of both together. So, you know, I don't think anyone's ever got this right. And we've called it many different things throughout the years, from the comprehensive approach to interagency to integrated review and integration and so on. It's always being reinvented. But I think the aiming point is absolutely right, which is, you know, particularly as the UK, you know, we can achieve most impact, most influence, and most value for money for our citizens if we are bringing all of our leaders of government together, because the sum of the whole is going to be greater than the sum of the constituent parts.
One of the great partnerships in the world is the one between the United States and the United Kingdom militaries. We just talked about Queen Elizabeth and Marine F-35s aboard. I remember being aboard Illustrious when there were 24 Harriers on the ship, and it was utterly fascinating to see that amount of capability coming off the deck that was as small as it did. There was a lot of hard work that made that happen. We would have gone to Farnborough, where we would have gotten kind of an update on a lot of these collaborative efforts. Sadly, we didn't do that because Farnborough was virtual. But bring us up to speed, sort of on the breadth of what consumes the bulk of your agenda, which is the U.S.-UK defense collaboration relationship. The nations share a lot of priority goals that are the same, whether it's in cyber, whether it's in space, whether it's in connectivity. And threat-wise, there's a reason Queen Elizabeth is making her first deployment to Asia. There's a lot of integrated thinking. The United Kingdom does FONOPS in the Pacific as well to sort of underscore the need for free navigation in international waters. Walk us through the totality of the work that you and your team are doing that I think a lot of times, you know, folks focus, for example, on Queen Elizabeth, but not the myriad of other agenda items that are making progress.
No, I mean, it absolutely right. You know, I've worked around this relationship with the US for, 20 years on and off. And it wasn't really until I got here that I started to appreciate just the extraordinary range and breadth of what we do together. I mean, we always say that this is the broadest, deepest, most advanced defense relationship of any two countries. But it's just staggering, actually. And, you know, trying to get across it and trying to track everything that's going on is pretty overwhelming. So, you know, to give you a few examples of that, I mean, the footprint that I and our defense attaché oversee here in the US is about 2,500 people across 28 states, military, civilian, and their families. There are, of course, about 20,000 US military personnel and their families based in the UK. So right there, you've got, you know, what that tells you is that the people-to-people links are, you know, unprecedented. I think we've got at least twice as many people in this country as the sort of next largest country, which I think is Canada. So that integration is really any major unit across the US, you will find a British liaison officer or an embedded officer who is working to build that partnership to make sure that, you know, when US, ultimately the aim is to make sure that when we deploy on operations together, you know, from day one or night one, we can work alongside each other effectively, seamlessly. And that takes an enormous amount of work. So, you know, we've mentioned the carriers, but that F-35 relationship, between our air forces is extraordinary. And there's huge exercise programs that underpin that interoperability. On the Navy side, our nuclear deterrent, I mentioned we're renewing it at the moment, but we're doing it in parallel with your Columbia class program. And indeed, about a third of those submarines will be identical through a common missile compartment, which we are building together across the UK and the US. And which will house eventually the Trident missile system, which, by the way, is operated out of Kings Bay in Georgia, a facility that the UK co-funds. So on the nuclear relationship, you know, extraordinary depth, intelligence as well. I mean, into the detail of that for obvious reasons. Also on the Navy, you know, everything from ships to submarines, we've got a real history here of partnership going back to the Cold War and before. And, you know, it is as live and kicking today as it has ever been. And then on the army side, you know, I saw a lovely thing this week around a British brigadier who has been the deputy commander of an American division deployed on operations in Afghanistan, who was just given the Legion of Merit for his work there. It is an extraordinary thing that we have deputy commanders of American corps and American divisions who are British. It is an extraordinary thing that every major in the British Army trains in the United States as a core part of their curriculum to prepare for command. We have Royal Air Force squadrons in Creech Air Base in Nevada actually flying Reaper missions across, you know, around the world alongside their US counterparts. So there's a huge amount in terms of the military-military relationship, which is, you know, fundamental really to what we do. And that's, you know, really powerful. A lot of what I spend my time doing is working on that kind of broad relationship. And you talked about the sort of alignment of our policy objectives, which, you know, is, remains an extraordinarily close alignment. There are areas where we disagree, and we've, you know, we've obviously seen those too. In big handfuls, we are on the same page and working together around the world as we have for decades. And so, you know, we have a lot of work through processes like the integrated review of talking to the teams who worked on your national defense strategy and working out, you know, where the alignment is. We have a huge program to try and, you know, build our interoperability together to make sure that as we design our future forces, we're not losing, but in fact enhancing where it makes sense to do so, that interoperability that underpins our usefulness and utility to each other as allies. We're working together on new technologies, a whole range of them, from AI to directed energy weapons to cyber and space. And also industrially, where I spend a lot of my focus as well. You know, extraordinary integration. We are buying $32 billion worth of US equipment over the next 10 years. Those are the programs that sustain and support 160,000 American jobs. You know, big British companies like BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce employ about 56,000 people across the United States. So that level of integration, you know, it goes right through the process from the sort of political and the policy, which is the world I inhabit most of the time, through the military and down into the kind of scientists, technologists, and indeed our industries. So, you know, against that backdrop, it's a massively exciting job to be here and doing. And, you know, and I feel so lucky to be here and you know, seeing that full range of our cooperation.
And of course, there's the Five Eyes, the extraordinary cooperation between the NSA and GCHQ, one of the world's most important single organizations, or I should say two of the world's most important organizations, especially in a time like this. And of course, space, which is, you know, it's amazing how many great power. It was rare that Britain didn't become a space power, even though it had the technology. But it's really interesting and fascinating to watch how innovative the British space sector has been, you know, especially over the past decade, and how much progress has been made there. Let me ask you two industrial questions as our time grows short. One is, the National Defense Authorization Act included, the House version of it included very restrictive Buy American provisions. Those look like they're going to be dropped in conference with the Senate. But the fact that the legislation got as far as it did stun a lot of our allies. It stunned a lot of people in Washington, in fact, and Britain was one of the nations that signed letters to Jack Reed and Jim Inhofe in the Senate, sort of saying, like, look, this is very, very problematic. We're in now an increasingly nationalistic and deglobalizing world. What's the right mentality that everybody has to bring to this, given how critically important international defense cooperation is, especially among close allies? And it's not just a US-UK thing, which some folks want to make it, because the UK is also partnered with dozens of countries around the world through which it's drawing technology that gets refined through British lenses and then brought to solve American problems, right? I mean, this is a very, very important ecosystem. What's your message to lawmakers when you meet with them about the mentality they have to bring to this? Because as you said, how many other nations are buying $33 billion in equipment that help employ more than 150,000 Americans?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think we're all struggling with similar questions and challenges right now. We all know that we have to work harder to protect our technology because it is under threat. Our IP is being pursued by our competitors. And we are, you know, having to work harder to maintain our technological edge. So we get it. We get that absolutely, and we're going through exactly the same process in the UK of working out where are the vulnerabilities that we need to shore up. At the same time, certainly from a UK perspective, that does not mean drawing out the drawbridge. You know, we absolutely believe that to maintain that technological advantage, we have to work with others. And indeed, there are many documents that I've read on this side of the Atlantic that have drawn the same conclusions, including, I think, the study that was done under presidential executive order a couple of years ago that highlighted some, you know, weaknesses or lack of resilience in the industrial base and said that working with allies is a critical way of plugging these gaps. You know, a lot of what I do is try and just build that sort of relationship. So, you know, if essentially the strategic objective is to try and maintain technology advantage, that's where my focus is. What are the things we need to do to allow that to happen? And there are positive things and negative things. You know, the negative things is to try and reduce or avoid the barriers that get in the way of rapid sharing of technology, of industrial collaboration and partnership. And there's loads of positive stuff as well. Our industries are producing really exciting stuff, you know, both in the UK and here. And there's lots of opportunities if we can share. So, you know, I think really the aim should be, and the, you know, certainly my objective here is to try and deepen that cooperation. And so anything that suggests that there may be barriers or obstacles, bureaucratic or legal, to that kind of cooperation is a concern, not just because we're buying a lot of American equipment and sustaining a lot of American jobs, and some of that might become harder to do. It's because strategically, you know, the only way we can maintain our technology advantage over a country of the scale of a country, China, is to work together. And I think that's as true for the United States as it is for the United Kingdom. So I think, you know, certainly my focus is on that strategic imperative, which is to advance and to speed up wherever we can our industrial collaboration and our technology cooperation, so that we can really drive forward and get these exciting new technologies, you know, out of the lab, build them at scale and get them into the hands of the warfighter, so that we can really work out, you know, how to use them to best advantage.
Let me ask you about that, right? The drive that the United States has is to field equipment more quickly. We saw from the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, I think the audience is getting tired of me saying this, but General Brown did put that extraordinary paper, very brief, worth reading, Accelerate Change or Lose. Every time the United States has kind of opened the throttles, the amount of money we're spending on research and development,
yeah,
and when that urgent fire is lit under the United States, we tend to lurch forward very, very quickly. And that creates a whole series of interoperability and capability gaps. Is that something that's of concern to you? And are we doing enough of a job thinking that through as we open up these throttles on this side of the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, you guys are spending an enormous amount of money. I think over $106 billion on RDT&E within the Department of Defense this year alone. That is a challenge for us to keep pace. You know, I think our interoperability is critical. So we have to work harder together, I think, as these technologies change, as we move more into spiral development and rapid incremental development of technologies, we have to make sure that we can stay tightly aligned. And really, that's where a lot of my focus is building those relationships to make sure that we're having the right conversations, that we are building interoperability from the beginning of these programs rather than an afterthought. Because we don't want to turn up on a battlefield one day and realize we can't communicate with each other or our weapons don't, you know, work alongside each other. So it is a critical importance.
Let me ask you about Tempest, extraordinary effort behind the scenes for very many years. United Kingdom looking to develop a sixth generation aircraft in partnership with Italy and with Sweden. I know the effort is still very, very nascent. But as you watch the next generation air dominance aircraft, Will Roper, the Air Force acquisition executive, sort of unveiled that it went from design to flying article in a year, setting records in the process. I know, you know, General Lozano, U.S. Air Force test chief, said, "Look, it was great, but there's a lot more work to come." But what does the effort tell you? And what are some of the lessons for Tempest? Right. And if you can sort of bring us up to speed on what's going on with that program, because it's really the repository of combat aircraft sovereignty for three nations with a very, very long history of achievement in combat aircraft excellence.
So I think
bring us up to speed on the yin and the yang of this as the program moves forward.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, Tempest, you know, it's obviously, you know, part of the integrated review, and ministers are yet to take firm decisions on precisely the scale and scope of the program. We're looking at a whole range of different options, including different partnering options. And we're very keen to keep talking to the United States about whether we could partner directly or you know, or how we maintain interoperability going forward. I do think it, you know, there are real advantages if we can maintain that industrial capability to develop sixth generation capabilities within the UK, and significant, obviously, you know, economic and other benefits for us. But you know, spreading that IP and that skill set across our countries, I think, is powerful and valuable. You know, it's really interesting to watch what the Air Force is doing here. I think there's, you know, there's really some massively exciting stuff going on. We're keen to, you know, learn from all that is going on here. And, you know, as again, on our side, you know, we've got some exciting, you know, some big experienced companies, BAE Systems, Leonardo, Rolls-Royce, MBDA, who are working together, you know, and again, we are looking at some quite exciting programs, including programs like Project Mosquito, which would create a loyal autonomous wingman to you know, future fighters, for example. So there's lots going on in this space, but it is, as you say, early days. It's one, I think, where it is, you know, that whole future combat aircraft arena is one which will, you know, as we've seen with F-35, is just so important as an underpinning of our interoperability going forward. So it's one where we need to keep talking.
And it's the last question that I asked you at the panel, and let me just ask you for a brief version of it. People get fixated on Brexit, and then they read ahead on that that somehow the United Kingdom will not be cooperating, right? For example, there can be no cooperation with the French and Germans because Brexit's going on and you have Tempest going on. That's the wrong way of looking at it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have left the European Union. We have not left Europe, and we have not left European security. We have not left NATO. So we are absolutely committed to working with our European friends and allies into the future. And we play, you know, we are playing a leading role in the NATO Readiness Initiative, and we will continue to be absolutely at the heart of European security.
Last personal question: you and I share a passion for Citroën de Chavaux. Why is that one of the not just most iconic, but best cars in history?
Well, perhaps because you can turn it over with one hand. I don't know. But we had a lovely red Citroën de Chavaux called Blossom, who was wonderful. We took her up Vesuvius once with six people in her, and she never went above 40 miles an hour again. So, you know, they're not exactly the fastest or most robust of cars, but they're very charming.
Fantastic. And thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it, and hope to have you on again periodically to give our audience an update on what's going on with one of the most consequential strategic relationships in the world. Thanks so very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Wagner.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.